in an effort to help out, since no one was particularly eager to answer the question I asked, which was, what are the factors which one must investigate in determining the precedent of possibility? I decided to produce this. You'll find it on your the blog page, and it's appropriately labeled. This is Skelly Wright on the doctrine of possibility and practicability. And the question is, well, what are the standards which he identified? What are the elements of his, this particular doctrine? So this is the part of the analytic process, if you will, that you're supposed to go through, at least in the view of Judge Wright, he's a smart guy, in deciding whether or not there is a defense of impossibility or practicability. I say defense because that's the way this is used. This is used by a party who is trying to resist enforcement of a contract, or a, if you will, a determination that they have breached the contract by their non-performance. So he says, well, first of all, there has to be an occurrence of an unexpected contingency. And all that means is that something unexpected must have occurred. That's our first step. Something unexpected must have occurred. Unallocated risk. That's the second step. You have to decide that the risk of the unexpected contingency has not been allocated by agreement or by custom, he says. So usage of the trade could do it for you. Otherwise, we have to look at what the agreement was, apparently. And notice that I flagged the word unexpected, because he says, pretty much in no uncertain terms, that foreseeability of the contingency does not necessarily prove that the risk has been allocated. Now, not everyone agrees about that. You can say that if the party who is now complaining about the risk foresaw the risk and did nothing in the agreement to protect against the risk, then the risk has been allocated. They've allocated it to themselves because they saw it and they didn't do anything about it. What he says, and also, as I pointed out, it's what the restatement now says and what the Uniform Commercial Code now says in its comments, although not in text, that the fact that you can foresee it may be a factor in determining whether there has been an allocation of risk, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the risk is allocated to the party who foresaw it or could have foreseen it. There has to be something more than foreseeability. Well, not every case agrees with that, and you read some opinions for today, one of which at least talks about foreseeability as though that decides the question, that if it was foreseeable, then it allocated the risk to the party who should have foreseen it, or who did foresee it. So an unallocated risk. So remember now, the first step is that something unexpected has to have occurred, and the second is that the risk of this unexpected contingency has not been allocated by agreement or by custom. And the third step is the contingency has made performance impossible or commercially impracticable. And we saw a number of definitions of commercial impracticability, including one attempt by the courts in Massachusetts in the Mishara case, I think it was, in which they talk about impracticable owing to some extreme or unreasonable difficulty, expense, injury, or loss involved, rather than that it's scientifically or actually impossible. That's not required. And that all automatically, of course, raises the question of, well, how bad does it have to be? And so if we decide that the contingency has made performance commercially impracticable, then the question becomes, well, how do we decide that it's commercially impractical? However, analytically, you must go through those three steps. So that if I ask you an impossibility question, that's what I expect to see in response. I expect to see you go through this process of first asking yourself, has something unexpected occurred, and if so, what was it? Second, was that risk of that occurring, even though it was unexpected, has it been allocated somehow or another, either by the agreement or by customer usage? And then finally, has it made performance commercially impractical? Three-part test. Okay. So tonight we're going to start with a case, Missouri Public Service Company versus Peabody Coal, in which the court does, among other things, have to explore what we mean by commercially impractical. What exactly does that mean? And let me ask you this. If you were preparing to argue this case, and you represented, well, let's put you on the representation side of the Peabody Coal Company. What do you think would you anticipate to be the most difficult part of your argument? Your argument here is that your costs have escalated well beyond anything contemplated by the contract, when you made the contract, and that these costs are so steep and were so unexpected that the court ought to provide you with a defense of impracticability, impossibility, so that you can stop delivering the coal without being regarded as having been in breach, because after all, you had a contract to deliver coal. What would you anticipate, given all the facts, to be your most difficult problem? What would you anticipate?
I think it's that you're going against a public service.
Okay, that's a possibility. Who was the buyer? The buyer was not an ordinary private enterprise.
Right.
Okay. Any other thoughts about what would be?
So, well, maybe like the argument of you made a bad bargain or you made a bad deal. Too bad.
Okay. The court should not interest itself just because the deal turned out to be a poor deal for you.
That you both agreed on what you would use to figure out the prices.
Okay. That you both agreed on an escalator clause. Escalator clause is one which says, well, our contract lasts over a period of time. We know that there are changes in market structure that are going to occur. And so what we're going to do is we're going to put a provision in. And what kind of provision was it? How did they do it? Did it just automatically go up 3% a year or 5% a year over the years of the agreement? What did they say? How did they do this clause?
They use the Industrial Commodities Index versus the Consumer Price Index.
Okay, and where does this come from?
I'm assuming Industrial Commodities.
United States Department.
Yeah, this comes from the United States. This is one of the things that, it's one of the things our government does. Right, our government does a few things, and one of the things it does, it produces a variety of indices. And so we can legitimately say that not only are they third party, but they are disinterested. Okay, so they are an unbiased voice. And of course, what they do is they have a kind of basket of things they look at to adjust that index. That's not the best known of the index. What is the best known index? The Consumer Price Index is by far the best known, and there are a whole bunch of things that are tied in our society that are tied to the Consumer Price Index. And we don't know in this case exactly why this was not tied to the CPI. What we do know is that in the first approach to the contract, the seller, our client, if you will, here, had proposed to use the CPI. That contract was turned down, but we don't know exactly why it was turned down. But we tried again with a new draft of it, which was largely the same as the old draft, except that it used a different index. This time the contract was made. we don't really know whether that change in index was really an important factor or whether this was just they weren't ready to contract the first time and they were ready to contract the second time. So, well, if we have an escalator clause, why are we in court complaining? I might legitimately say to my client, we wrote in this escalator clause to take care of the contingency of what? What contingency were they trying to take care of when they write in an escalator clause? What contingency or contingencies are they trying to take account of? Yeah, increase in cost. That's probably not the only one they're trying to take account of. They're probably also trying to take account of the increased value of their product in the marketplace, which could be different than their cost. If suddenly everybody wants coal, so demand increases, well, then the value of what you're selling increases, even though your cost may remain the same. So it could be either one, but probably the thing they're most worried about when they insist upon an escalator clause is that their costs will increase. So what are they complaining about here? They used an index, an escalator index. They did it because they were concerned about their prices increasing. And so what's the rest of the story?
Because of the oil embargo, the price of coal went way up, so now they can sell for more.
Yeah. One of the things that happens in the energy industry is that a contraction in supply of any element in the energy industry will result in the rise in the price of all the others, of all, really. So that when coal, for any reason, you have a coal strike, the price of natural gas and the price of oil rise. If you have an oil embargo, the price of coal and natural gas rise. And the driving force behind that fact, it's obviously not us when we drive our car. We don't have the choice between switching between coal and gasoline, or even gasoline and natural gas, except for a few cars. It's the electric power industry. Because years ago, in order to protect themselves against this very cyclical character of prices suddenly rising in one or the other of these energy sources, have the capacity of either switching the individual plant or maximizing the output of some of their plants that use the less expensive fuel. A lot of them now use coal and natural gas, or coal and oil, or in some cases coal, natural gas, and oil. They have the facility to use any of the three to produce the electrical energy that we use. But the result of that is that the demand that they make, oh, I can't buy coal now, well, then I'm going to have to buy more oil. That increases the demand for oil and the price of oil goes up. Same thing with natural gas. And here, the same thing with coal. The electric power generation industry said, uh-oh, we can't buy oil now because of the oil embargo. Okay, we'll burn coal. And that immediately increases demand for coal. You increase the demand for coal, the price of coal goes up. So one of the things that happened was a market price, but that doesn't talk about cost. The fact that there's an embargo on oil does not increase their cost. Well, it increases everybody's cost, maybe, in some fashion or another, but it's not a major driver of cost. The fact that oil was embargoed drove up the price of oil and, of course, gasoline, all the derivatives of oil. Now, coal miners use, of course, some electricity in the process of mining, but it's not a major factor in their cost. So what else was going on here? Did they have cost increases?
Shipping costs
later? Well, their shipping costs may have increased. Of course, that happens. The cost of transportation goes up with any change in the price structure for fossil fuels. Labor costs were going up significantly at this point in the industry. The cost of responding to federal government safety regulations was driving the cost of coal up and reducing coal output. So they're
they're hurting. Now, they're hurting in part because of the phenomenon of what had happened to the index. The CPI was skyrocketing, by the way, as it tends to do when the price of fossil fuels goes up. Indeed, they took gasoline out of the CPI because they felt it was distorting it. That's not so good for us, of course. We pay more money on the pump, and yet the consumer price index claims not to be moving very much, even though the price of gasoline is getting close to doubling these days. We don't know what happened. Right? The court doesn't tell us, I don't know. But for some reason or another, the index that they chose to use was not, in fact, much impacted by the changes in the dynamics of the marketplace that were increasing the coal company's production cost and, of course, increasing the value of their product, a value which they would like to be able to recover by selling their coal in the spot market instead of delivering it at this much lower price to this buyer or any other buyer. This is a major buyer with a long-term supply contract. So our problem, you would expect, would be that the escalator clause. Now, why exactly do we think that the presence of an escalator clause would create problems in what we're asking the court to do, which is to apply the doctrine of impossibility in our or impracticability in our behalf? What's that logical nexus?
Because if you have an escalator clause, it means that it was somewhat foreseeable.
It means that it was somewhat foreseeable. Is it more than that, though? Is it more than it's somewhat foreseeable? That's a good argument, but is it more than foreseeable?
I think it's assuming a risk.
Yeah, it's an allocation of risk. Because after all, if you're sitting there saying, well, I want an escalator clause, I'm going to bargain for an escalator clause, and here's the index to which I want to tie the escalator clause, you are necessarily assuming the risk that your costs might go up faster than that index goes up, and indeed the buyer is undertaking the risk, that in fact, that is not the case. That is, that the cost of coal in the marketplace was not, in fact, increasing at the same rate as the index is increasing. Each party is allocating to itself a particular risk associated with the comparison of what the index says and other cost factors and other value factors in the marketplace. That, I think, is the problem. If I were their lawyer, I'd say to myself, how am I going to manage to avoid the argument that there has been in the agreement an allocation of the risk? And that means, under the doctrine of impracticability, that there's been an allocation of this risk, and therefore, I can't use the doctrine. I can't expect the court to apply this doctrine in my favor. So now the problem is, how do I get around that? At least I can't get around it, probably, but what are my arguments for trying to avoid the impact of that?
The embargo of the things overseas was a contingency that had not been planned for.
Okay. That when we talked about the index, we didn't have in mind an allocation of the risk that there would be an oil embargo. We included the price index because of other cost factors that we assumed would be present. But an oil embargo? We didn't expect that. Of course, that's an argument that none of us can make anymore, right? We can't make arguments about possible oil shortages. But that was the argument I think they tried to make. That's what it was. So that notice what you have to do. We have to identify, remember, let's take us through the Skelly-Wright steps. The Skelly-Wright steps say the occurrence of an unexpected event. The truth is, I think, that the unexpected event here was that the index didn't work for them. But that's not one that they're going to be able to make effective use of in a court of law. It's the one they chose. It was in their draft. So they have to identify instead the embargo and say, aha, Your Honor, the unexpected event was the embargo. And while you may think that we allocated the risk of changes in market price and value over time by using the index, Your Honor, that's really not the problem here. We're arguing that our desperate economic circumstances are the result of the impact of the unexpected Arab oil embargo, the OPEC embargo on the exportation of oil to Western countries. That's what it was. And, Your Honor, there's nothing in our agreement which is designed to allocate that risk. Didn't occur to us. Maybe it should have, Your Honor, but it didn't. And therefore, we would like you to grant us this defense. Now, the last step, of course, is that it makes it impracticable. What's our argument that it's impractical for us to deliver coal now? Are we having any trouble getting the coal? Is the coal no longer in the ground? Did the Arabs manage to block our workers so that they can't go in and dig coal? No.
They lost a lot of money.
Yeah, we're losing money. That's right. That's the argument. We're losing a lot of money, Your Honor. We're losing a lot of money. And this is a basic problem which has plagued this body of law. There's no doubt about it. Is that never a good argument? Is it always a good argument? How much do you have to be losing? You're losing your shirt. Do you have to be losing your pants, socks, shoes, and everything else too? I mean, how much do you have to be losing? Now, this case, why did they lose the case? Exactly. Long opinion this guy wrote, isn't it?
Well, one of the problems is that Missouri Public offered a dollar increase per ton and they refused that outright. So that made it seem like they weren't arguing in good faith.
Okay. So they've got a problem here, right? Because they have problems identifying the nexus between the Arab oil embargo and the reason that they would like the relief. The reason they'd like the relief is the extent that they're losing money here, because they could sell their coal for a lot more money to some other buyer. This is a losing argument. I made a bad bargain argument. They can't do that. They have to argue losing, not in the paper sense that we're losing money because in delivering coal to them for X, we could be selling it to somebody else for 10 times X. Too bad. When you enter a long-term contract, that can always happen. Incidentally, sometimes it goes the other way. Your buyer has got to pay you a lot more money than your buyer can buy the product at the market price, because the market price has not risen as quickly as the escalator clause rose. That happens too. That's one of the risks that you undertake when you make a long-term contract and use a fixed price or even an escalated price, but you tie that price to some index. No matter what you tie it to, there's a risk for both sides. They've got to argue we're losing money, Your Honor, in the sense that we're not getting enough money from the buyer to cover our costs. And the question is, well, exactly why did that happen? Why did that occur? Something which they never, I think, adequately explained or explained to the satisfaction of the court. When the court gets around to talking about the Arab oil embargo, that's on page 792, it's really near the very end of the opinion. And it says, the other claim made by Peabody alleged to bring it within doctrine of commercial impracticability is the Arab oil embargo, and then look what they do. Such a possibility was common knowledge that had been thoroughly discussed and recognized for many years by our government. But they also say, Peabody failed to demonstrate that this embargo affected its ability to secure oil or petroleum products necessary to its mining production. albeit at an inflated cost. So, from the standpoint of the court, there were two problems about the attempted use of the embargo. Sure, that was one of their arguments. That was probably the strongest argument they have, although you can't tell from the way the opinion was written. But they say, the court says, look, first of all, you should have known about it. Now, this is always a tough problem. In transatlantic, the fact of the matter is that when that shipping contract was made, it was understood that there was serious unrest in Egypt, that anything could happen. And that matters because the Suez Canal is Egypt. But the other interesting problem is that the court said, in effect, look, even if that was an unexpected occurrence, and even if the risk was not really allocated in connection with that occurrence, nevertheless, we don't think that its economic impact was sufficient to warrant the application of the doctrine of impossibility. What would it have taken? I don't know. I suppose that if they weren't generating enough revenue to pay for the oil and had to go out of business entirely, maybe that would have done it. Maybe the court would have given them relief. But that wasn't their situation. They were still mining coal. It was just more expensive to mine it, and what's more, they could sell it for more money. So it's an interesting example of an effort by lawyers to make use of the doctrine of impossibility, and it was a failure. I myself think it was doomed to be a failure. This is the kind of case in which I hope that they told their client, we're going to lose this case. Look, if you want to litigate it, sure, I don't mind. You know, I charge you $5,000 a day for trial. And I'll be there for quite a while because it's going to be a lengthy trial. We have a lot to prove. But we're going to lose. And they did. Okay. Now, Georgia Power versus Cimarron Coal Company, you know, in some ways, maybe I should have said, don't bother reading it. It's most worthwhile, however, to make a point that we don't otherwise make in this course, although we probably should, because students come out of first year always with a very sort of litigation orientation, and it's partly our fault. It's because what you read is always litigated cases. There is an act in Congress, the Federal Arbitration Act, that says if an agreement says that a dispute will be settled by arbitration, there's no jurisdiction in the federal courts. It goes to arbitration. Now, you can appeal from an arbitration, and if you otherwise meet federal jurisdictional requirements, you can be in the federal court. However, the only thing you can argue at that point is either that the winning side bribed the arbitrator, or the arbitrator was under the influence of drugs when reaching the decision. I mean, it's pretty much that serious. You just can't get arbitrations overturned without proving effectively corruption on the part of the arbitrator. The fact that the arbitrator made an error of law, so what? If the parties have agreed to arbitration, the arbitrator has a general requirement to respect law, but the arbitrator decides the case the way the arbitrator wants to decide the case. It's a very powerful tool. Its benefit is said to be that it's less expensive. It is a little less expensive. It's faster. It's a lot faster. And it's a lot faster primarily because all of our courts, federal and state, are overwhelmed with criminal work. And the result is that civil work, they don't get around to it for a long time. And the result is that the calendars for civil work get longer and longer, particularly if one side or the other demands a jury. Then we're talking about 4 years or 5 years before you ever get to trial, and then another 3 or 4 years in appeals, and it could be a decade before you see an end of it. Arbitration is more likely to be done in a month or two. And so it's an appealing alternative. And if you look at consumer contracts, if you look at the contracts of anything you buy, and you remember Judge Posner says that those are contracts that are that bind us, you will find that the language always says it shall be arbitrated. And those arbitration clauses, I only know of one arbitration clause which has ever been stricken, and that was one in New Jersey court, which I can't remember what the goods were that were being sold, but they said it had to be arbitrated in London. And otherwise, the transaction was completely in New Jersey. And the New Jersey court struck it on the ground that that was an unconscionable provision because of the expense that it would have involved for the consumer having to undertake an arbitration in London. So this case, you see an arbitration clause, and you see an effort on the part of one of the parties to get into court. And they wanted to get into court by arguing that the impossibility doctrine prevents the enforcement of this contract, and therefore there's nothing to arbitrate. Now that's a very, analytically, a very interesting argument, and one that's kind of a little beyond where we go in this course, because it is true that, let's say, that the argument they were making here is, Your Honor, there was no consideration underlying this agreement, or there was no mutual assent. Let's say there was fraud in the inducement to enter the contract. That the courts will entertain, despite the arbitration clause, was what you're arguing is that the contract itself is invalid. It's not a valid contract. It's a void agreement. And therefore, the arbitration clause is part of a void agreement, and therefore should not be respected. The problem with trying to use it in an impossibility case is that you're not really arguing that the contract was void. Indeed, you're acknowledging that the contract existed, but are arguing that it should no longer be binding on one of the parties because of the occurrence of an event, the non-occurrence of which was a basic assumption upon which the contract was made. That was their problem here. And the court said, if that's what you're arguing, you go to arbitration. The arbitrator, you can make the argument to the arbitrator. If the arbitrator is sympathetic to that argument, you'll win. If they're not, you'll lose. You can appeal to us, and you'll probably lose again. So there's a little bit going on here that's of interest, but you're told, although we don't have the opinion, you're told about the Alcoa case, one of the stranger cases among the group of cases that concern themselves with the impossibility or impracticability doctrine or the frustration of purpose, whichever this was. It had followed, I mean, the intriguing thing about the Alcoa case, it had followed a group of cases which are, as a bunch, known as the uranium cases. And the uranium cases were, they're all the same. What happened was that uranium mining companies had made long-term contracts with, you can hiss and boo now, the nuclear power industry. And they were, these long-term contracts are fairly critical to the nuclear power industry. Well, it turned out that there was less uranium than was expected. The geologists got it wrong. And furthermore, that the cost of mining a lot of the uranium that could be mined was a lot higher than was expected. The impact of those two meant that the price of uranium went quite high in comparison to the price quoted in those long-term contracts. And the uranium companies all wanted relief from the contracts based on the arguments, argument of impossibility or commercial impracticability. And they lost. They all lost. The court said, you made a contract. They all had escalator clauses in them, by the way. You made a contract, had an escalator clause. There's clearly an allocation of risk. You knew that this could happen. Everybody knows it could happen over a long-term contract. You didn't got the right escalator clause, that's too bad, but that's one of those bad bargains. It doesn't make it an unenforceable agreement, and they were all thrown out of court. So that makes it particularly strange that we come along with Alcoa, and what happened with Alcoa is that to make aluminum, you use lots and lots and lots of electricity. It is the single largest cost factor in the production of aluminum. And so Alcoa was in a situation in which it looked like they were going to lose about $75 million on this contract because of the unexpectedly high cost of electricity. And they win in the United States District Court. Now, one of their arguments, interestingly enough, was an argument, and it's worthwhile thinking about it just because of the nexus of these two doctrines here. They argued mistake. What was their mistake theory? How can Alcoa argue mistake? What was the mistake?
It seems like they both thought the index that they agreed on was going to do one thing and didn't.
Yeah. Wrong index. Wrong index. The mistake was they both agreed on what they wanted the index to do, and the argument by Alcoa was it was the wrong index, and therefore there was a mistake being made. And the court says the case is clearly established that mutual mistake lies in error concerning mutually understood material facts. When Alcoa proposed the price formula, which appears in the contract, Essex has managed to examine the past behavior of indices for stability to assure they would not cause their final aluminum cost to deviate unacceptably from the market price. Alcoa's manager was equally attentive to risk limitation. So, what does that mean to us? Is that a proper use of the law of mistake? I mean, let's suppose that the parties had said, bargaining orally, of course, and they had said, you know, let's use the consumer price index. And they agreed to it. They handed it over to their lawyers, and their lawyers wrote it out, and the lawyers used this index. What legal argument would Alcoa and Essex then make, or might they either of them make?
They could agree to use the consumer price, not this.
Right, and therefore, what relief would they ask for? That we've talked about. Think of Martin Luther, it'll help.
Reformation?
Yes. Reformation. Yeah, they would say, look, Your Honor, we had an agreement. We had an agreement, but the lawyers wrote it down incorrectly. So the contract has to be reformed to be what our agreement was, reformation. And that is certainly an available relief, but they would have had to prove that there was a specific index which they had agreed to. Here they didn't have that. So reformation is not possible. They both agreed to this index, that the index didn't do what, at least they argue, Alcoa argues the index didn't do what they thought it would do. That's not a basis for reformation. Is it enough of a mistake? Is it a mutual mistake? Is it enough of a mistake to grant an excuse from the contract? Now, they also said that Alcoa has also satisfied the requirements of both impossibility and frustration. The impracticability of its performance is clear. The increase in its cost of performance severe enough to warrant relief. Why? And they're going to lose $75 million during the remaining of this contract. So This is Alcoa we're talking about. Does that mean they're going to be in bankruptcy? Does it say, hey, Your Honor, we'll be in bankruptcy, we won't be able to afford to cover our debts as they become due? Just the standard for bankruptcy. Does it mean that our liabilities will exceed our assets? Another measure of bankruptcy? They didn't say that. They said, well, we're going to lose $75 million. Oh, we're Alcoa. What's the frustration? The only frustration is we thought we were going to make money and we're not. That's not, as we'll see, that's not what the frustration cases say. So, this is a ridiculous case. But interesting what happens. What happened to the case? And it's why we don't have an appellate opinion after all. We have little excerpts from the trial court opinion.
They appealed and it settled and then it was remanded and dismissed.
It was appealed. They then settled between them, right? They settled. Once they settled, they then moved to dismiss the appeal. But the court obviously did not much like the decision by the United States District Court. And so what they did is they said that, yeah, you made a joint motion requesting voluntary dismissal, vacation of the district court judgment, and remand of the case to the district court with direction to dismiss. And John Wallace, who's the teacher on this faculty, by the way, in this article that he wrote on this case, says that he was told by the judges of the Third Circuit that, you know, you can consider this about as persuasive as a law review article. I wanted you to know that coming out of the mouths of judges, that doesn't mean the same thing as it might come out of the mouth of a law professor. Since judges say, law review articles, they like it when they can use it for support, but they are otherwise not terribly interested. Okay. But let's move on to, so Alcoa is this oddball case, really oddball case in which the court was prepared to use mistake, impossibility, and even frustration for the relief of this company, and they probably did not qualify for any of the three under appropriate application of these doctrines. And that's what the Third Circuit was in effect saying, informally. Let's look at poor Bobby Murray. Poor Bobby Murray, Murray Chevrolet, got himself into a lot of trouble. Now, what's his argument? There. He's arguing impracticability, right? Commercial impracticability. He's very close to arguing impossibility. He can't quite make it to that, but he's arguing commercial impracticability, at least. What is the contingency, the non-occurrence of which was the basic assumption upon which the contract was made here?
The EPA regulations have enacted the emission standards that their motors wouldn't, that Bobby Murray's motors wouldn't.
Okay, one of the things that happened was the EPA standards. And the EPA standards meant that the motor that they were going to be using was, could not in fact qualify. It couldn't pass the EPA emission standards.
Wasn't it that GM couldn't fill their orders on time?
They argue that GM could not fill their orders for, what was GM delivering?
The chassis.
Right. So they were not able to get those from General Motors. Why were they seeking to get them from General Motors?
They were then turning around and selling them to the Department of Education.
I understand that, but why General Motors? Are they the only ones that make these things?
No, but they were a Chevy dealership.
Yeah, they're a General Motors dealership, but you'll see why I made that point in just a second. One of the points that the court makes is what about these non-available parts from General Motors? Yeah, they could have gotten them from a number of different sources. They could have gotten them from a number of different sources. Their argument is that, well, we're General Motors dealer and that's what we expected to do. But on the other hand, did the contract say that that's what they had to provide? No. That was a critical part. So watch that for a moment, because this theme is going to come up again. If you are dependent upon a single source of supply, and that source of supply fails, you may very well have a good case of impossibility. Let's skip ahead for a second. Let's apply it to farmers. I have a farm and I grow green beans on my farm. And I make a contract with Birdseye to sell Birdseye my crop of green beans. If I just say, Birdseye, I hereby promise to sell you 30 bushels of green beans, and now I have a crop failure, I don't deliver the green beans, and Birdseye sues the farmer. And the farmer says, but Your Honor, I had a crop failure. It was impossible for me to deliver 30 bushels of green beans. I didn't have even one bushel of green beans to deliver. It was impossible. The court looks at the contract, and the contract says, I, the farmer, promise to deliver to Birdseye 30 bushels of green beans. Now, I will tell you, why is it written that way? Guess who wrote it?
Birdseye
wrote it. Compare that. How should it have been written? If you were representing the farmer, what would you have insisted upon?
Say 30 bushels of peas from growing on my farm.
I think it was green beans, but that's okay. 30 bushels of green beans from my farm. You identify the source of supply. What he didn't do here was he didn't identify his source of supply for the chassis. And so he can't argue the impossibility based upon the fact that he couldn't get the chassis from that particular source. The court says, yeah, but you could have gotten the chassis. How about his problem with the motor, with the EPA regulations? The EPA had adopted emission limitations, and that this particular engine could not pass those emissions limitations. After all, one of the bases of a lot of litigation is that government regulation has made performance of the contract impossible. And by and large, that's a successful argument. If a regulation of a government, federal, state, or local, makes it impossible for you to do lawfully what you had promised to do, you would not be surprised to know that you are relieved of the burden of that contract under the doctrine of impossibility. At least you are, if you can show that that was the occurrence of an unexpected event, and that there had been no allocation of the risk.
The issue with they said about the EPA is that was written into the contract that if there was any change, they were to let the buyer know, and they would talk about it, and they could cancel the contract if need be. And the risk of doing that was allocated specifically to the seller, and he didn't do anything.
He didn't do what he was supposed to do. The agreement had a procedure which could be followed by the seller here. By Mary Chevrolet. He had a procedure to follow which would have taken care of this particular problem. He could have gone and said, we can't use that engine, we can use this engine as a substitute or whatever it is he wanted to propose at the same price. He could have negotiated for a different price, but he didn't do any of it. He didn't do any of it, he just didn't do it. And so the possibility of arguing that as a source of impossibility, he lost. He lost. If he had gone to them and said, well, it's now unlawful, you can't buy this motor. And they said, well, that's too bad. You contracted to deliver that motor, and you have to deliver it with that motor. He would have won that case. But he lost because he didn't do that. That raises an interesting question, by the way, of whether a court would apply that same reasoning if this clause had not been present. After all, this is a question that we'll have to look at a little later, What are his obligations as a person performing a contract when he finds out that one part of the contract cannot be performed? In this case, cannot be performed because of a governmental regulation. But it could be, it could not be performed because it's physically impossible. Anyways. Maybe you'd say, well, didn't he have some sort of obligation to go to the buyer and say, hey, we can't do what we had planned to do? You have the possibility of modifying the contract to develop it to a contract, make it a contract which they can perform? I'm not sure. If so, that would come under the doctrine, of course, of good faith, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. What are you required to do as you perform a contract and as you run into some difficulties to performance of the contract? So the court says you can't use the exclusive source of supply because the contract doesn't require a GM chassis. There's no single source clause in the contract. And furthermore, they're inclined to think that the events that occurred truly were foreseeable. Now, you remember that we've said that foreseeability is not itself a sufficient factor to lead you to the conclusion there's been an allocation of the risk. I'm not so sure that's true for this court. When this court talks about foreseeability, they seem to suggest that maybe foreseeability alone is enough. It was foreseeable that GM might not supply the bus chassis. Failure to make express provision for a foreseeable contingency in a sales contract implicitly places the burden of loss on the seller when the contingency comes to fruition. If you take that literally, this court is saying that the fact of foreseeability is sufficient to represent an allocation of risk, something which the restatement, the UCC, at least do not appear to agree with. And then we get the intervening government regulation argument, and the court says, you didn't do what you had to do. When you learned about it, you should have gone under the agreement, you should have gone to the buyer and let the buyer know. Now, compare that to selling Pontiac GMC versus King. This is also another vehicle case. The bodies are to be manufactured for King by Superior Manufacturing in Morris, Manitoba. They order four bus chassis from General Motors. Superior goes out of business. The bodies were never manufactured. The customer cancels its order. He sells the four chassis at a loss, and he sues King for damages. And King wins. Why?
Because in this case, they had identified that the chassis were coming from Superior and nobody could perceive any fraud
of history. Exactly. Okay. So you all got that message? Okay. Failure of source of supply is an occurrence, the non-occurrence in which the basic assumption of contract was made. You can get a defense of impracticability or possibility, but it has to be a limited source of supply that has failed. One that is identified in the contract. Okay, let's move over to frustration, one of my favorite subjects. Frustration. Crowell versus Henry is a case very similar to the case we've already talked about, right? We talked about it as part of the law of the state, when the parties make a contract thinking that it's going to be a coronation, but the coronation has already been scrubbed, and the court says, aha, well, that was a mistake. And they grant a defense against enforceability of the contract. Crowell versus Henry, this is the opposite case now. This is a case in which the parties make the contract. The time they make the contract, the coronation is supposed to happen. It's canceled at the very last minute when the doctors decide that the king needs surgery. And the landlord here, the owner, wants the rest of the payment. He got what? He got 25 pounds, but he wants another 75 pounds, I think, the rest of the payment, because it was a 100 pounds agreement. 100 pounds was the amount that was to be paid. So he has 25, but he wants the other 75, and so he sues. And the person who he is suing, the person who had arranged to use the rooms, daytime only, defends on the doctrine of, well, it's a part of the doctrine of impossibility or impracticability, and it's labeled frustration. Because the truth is that it's not impossible for him to use the room. He can go and stare out the windows. It's impossible to see the coronation procession that day because it's not going to happen for another month. Because it's been postponed. But it's not impossible. So the word impossibility doesn't seem to fit. But what you can say about it is that the parties both assumed that the coronation procession was going to occur. How do we know that the person renting the rooms knew that? That's right. This whole contract was based upon this. We just happened to know that, which probably means he charged more money. And remember the oddity, he was going to use it daytime only, which meant that he could rent out the rooms at night if he wanted. So both parties understood that the goal here of the contract was for the person who was renting the room or leasing the room or licensing the room to be able to look out the window and see the coronation procession, and that didn't happen. So there is a, quote, frustration of purpose. The purpose of the contract could not be achieved. It could be performed, but it would be without satisfying the intended purpose of the contract. Okay. So, now, one of the interesting things about, what about that 25 pounds? What had happened at the trial court about the 25 pounds?
The plaintiff made the counterclaim.
And what happened in the counterclaim? Did he win or lose?
Didn't he rescind his counterclaim?
At the trial court.
Oh, I know.
You got his $25?
He got his 25 pounds back. No. Yeah. Not only did the court decided for him both on the claim and the counterclaim. So the court decided against the claim for 75 pounds and for him and his counterclaim to get his 25 pounds back. Then they came up on appeal, and for whatever reason, he withdrew the counterclaim. And the court refers to that, and they say, as that claim is now withdrawn, it is unnecessary to say anything about it. I don't know what they would have said. What should they have said? What's the problem about this? If this had been a case of mutual mistake, which I think the other case was that we talked about, the other room rental to see a parade, what would the court have done with that 25 pounds?
They would have given the 25
pounds. On what grounds?
Mutual mistake simply means
there's no the contract's been avoided.
Well, in this case that there was,
The contract has been avoided, on what ground would the court order the 25 pounds to be paid back?
Oh, unjust enrichment.
Yes. Yes, unjust enrichment. Restitution. It would have been a restitutionary recovery. Would not have been pursuant to contract. Right, because there's no contract. The contract has now been avoided. It was voidable and it's been avoided. It's a little more difficult if it's frustration of purpose or impossibility, because the court is not finding that the contract is void. It was a good contract. There was nothing wrong with it. All they're deciding is we won't enforce it. But that leaves the 25 that had been paid. Could you bring an action of restitution for it? Well, no, because the problem is that it was a part of a contract. It was a contract obligation of his to pay 25 pounds. And the contract is a valid contract. The landlord cannot enforce it, the owner can't enforce it, because of the doctrine of frustration or impossibility, frustration of purpose, But that doesn't mean that it was not a valid existing contract at the point that £25 was paid. That was the contract performance of the renter, of the license, of the license, licensor, licensee. So we don't know what would have happened. This is one of these questions about how do you ever unwind these impossibility cases when somebody is out some money? And I told you some language in the restatement and some cases in England, which say, but not many in the United States, which say, well, maybe we'll take that. There's going to be a loss of £25 here, so we'll divide it. You know, so give back $12.50, something. But the general run of cases is, hey, we just walk away from it. It's now impossible. Nobody can bring any action. It's all over. We won't enforce whatever is undone. The unperformed part of the contract will never have to be performed. The performed part of the contract's been performed. That's it. There's been no breach, and so we can't talk about restitution in the absence of an agreement. There's been no breach, so we can't talk about reliance expenditures. All of that not available. Chase Precast. In the Massachusetts case, 1991, not a long, long time ago. For once, not a problem of corruption in Massachusetts, but a problem of but public action, public reaction. So a contract for a road, they're going to widen the street, and as part of the street improvement, they're going to take out a nice planted median strip, which in Springfield we always refer to as terrace. And they're going to put at least temporarily, concrete barriers that we're all familiar with as drivers that they use for while they're working on road repair. These very ugly things. And that's what the contract calls for. And so the party who's taking care of the, who's doing the work with John J. Payonessa Company, makes a contract with Chase Precast Corporation to make these things. And they cast them in molds and bring them out to the site. And they start right away into production, as they're required to do, and they make lots of them. They deliver a whole bunch to the site. Meanwhile, folks who live along the way or use that roadway, see what's going on. They start protesting. The city backs down, decides maybe that was not a good idea. We'll do it some other way, but we won't put those barriers there that we were going to put there for safety reasons. We won't do that. And so Payonessa says to Chase, hey, no more. Don't make any more. We're not going to be able to use them. And pays him for all the ones that have been delivered. Pays Chase for all the ones that have been delivered. But Chase had only delivered about a half at that point. And so from Chase's point of view, if the buyer is not going to buy those concrete barriers, it will mean for them an expectation loss, right? The amount of profit that they would have made on the as yet unproduced barriers. And so they sue. And Payonessa says, well, wait a second now. Can they argue impossibility? Is it impossible for them to pay for these barriers? No. Absolutely not. They could buy them. They could buy them, stick them in some warehouse. Or they could buy them. Not impossible to buy them. What's their argument? What's Payonessa trying to argue, trying to persuade the court here? By way of defense against Chase's action for breach of contract, you promised to pay for all of them. You only pay for half. We didn't make the other half yet, but we've lost the profit that we were going to make on that other half. And so we're entitled to our lost profit, as our expectation remedy for breach of contract. The only defense to this right is that Payoneer has to say we didn't breach the contract. But the contract called for them to buy all of them, and they didn't buy all of them, so what's their argument?
Frustration.
Well, you're going to have to say more than the word frustration, though, aren't you?
They didn't need to have me for the contract because of what the city did. It was no fault of their own. And because of that, they didn't require the additional materials. It wasn't their fault, so they had the right to not have those further materials.
So there's been an unexpected occurrence here. The unexpected occurrence was the decision not to use those barriers as part of this road project.
Right.
Okay. And the result of that is, we said that it's not impossible for them to buy the barriers, but. Well, it's not commercially impractical for them to buy them either. They're arguing frustration, but what's the nature, how do you make a frustration argument here? What's the frustration argument? What was the purpose for which they made this agreement?
Put barriers down the highway.
Yes, to put the barriers down the middle of the highway. And was that purpose understood by Chase and by as well as by Payoneer? Obviously Payoneer understood. But
now that's not the purpose.
But they understood it too, right? They both understood that the purpose was to have enough barriers to put down the middle of this roadway in connection with the roadwork that was being done by Payoneer under contract. And that purpose of use of that way has been frustrated by this unexpected event, namely the determination that they could not, in fact, use those barriers down the middle of the road as part of this construction job. What's the court do? Who wins? Payoneer or? Payoneer wins. The court decides that about this case, one can legitimately say that there's been a occurrence of event, the non-occurrence of which was the basic assumption upon which the contract was made, that there has been no allocation of the risk of this happening, and we have to change the language a little bit for the last test. The purpose for which the contract was made, a shared purpose between the two, could no longer be accomplished because of the occurrence of that unexpected event. That last step changes a little bit. You don't say it's impossible or impractical performance. You now say that performance has no purpose. The shared purpose is not achievable anymore because of the occurrence of the unexpected event. Well, now I turn to power engineering. I have to turn to power engineering. Because what you need to do for me is to compare Chase Precast, the case we just talked about, with power engineering. Engineering wins its action for the unpaid purchase price here. So that's the equivalent of Chase Precast winning in their action against Payoneer, but of course they lost. So the question is this simply it's Iowa and Iowa has a different rule than Massachusetts, or is there something different about the facts of this case that might lead the court to distinguish between the two if they had been asked to do that?
Well, in this case, Krug International did not know I got my people mixed up. Power Engineering did not know that it was creating something that was going to be used by Iraq. Therefore, versus in the previous case where Chase knew that when they were no longer going to use the median barriers, their product was no longer necessary.
Okay. Now, if you were representing Krug And knowing what you know now about this case, if you were representing Krug, how might you have written the contract in order to avoid this result?
Well, if you included the purpose as a condition, you are creating this item for purpose, for the express purpose of our ability to sell this item to Iraq.
And it's more than to sell. Did they have a contract?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So that you attempt to write in to the contract an identification of the your objective for the contract with Power Engineering. Will that necessarily do it? I don't know. But it will get you closer. It really is the other side of the coin of the single, of the identification of the supply source. And you're saying, just as you want to identify the supply source in order to prepare yourself for an argument about impossibility, you want to identify the use that you intend to make of what you're buying, if you're the buyer, in an effort to try and, in effect, allocate this risk that your buyer may disappear and that you don't want to be liable to your seller. The name of the game here is all risk allocation. The doctrine of impossibility is simply there to tell you what the court will do to fill a gap, if you will. The gap that the court finds is that something has occurred which you have not taken care of in any way in the contract. And it's an you're arguing, there's an argument now of an unexpected event. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to come up with some way of avoiding what may be an adverse decision that really is a gap-filling decision. The best way to do that is undoubtedly, if you can get the parties to agree, to allocate the risks and articulate the allocation of risks. There's nothing about this body of law which automatically allocates risk as against the parties. This is not an area where this is a rule of law. It's not regulatory in character. It's not a body of law which states who ought to bear the risk of an unexpected event occurring. Instead, it's what happens if the agreement is silent with respect to an allocation of risk. This is what the court will do. So you have to look at this as a gap filler. The same way we'd look at, gee, if the parties haven't said when the goods have to be delivered, the court will fill in the gap and say within a reasonable time. If the contract doesn't say where delivery is to take place, it will say delivery is to take place at the physical residence or the physical plant of the buyer. That these are gap fillers, the parties are invited to write provisions on their own. And whatever those provisions are, the court will enforce. This is the same. This is a gap filler that fills the gap that exists, but this is one which the parties have not addressed. They've not addressed it, perhaps, because they haven't thought about it. The surprising thing about these cases is that in so many instances, what actually occurred is something that the parties could have imagined occurring and could have written a better contract for. So all those ships that didn't know whether to go around the Cape of Good Hope or go back to port, they had known for some time that there was unrest in Egypt that possibly threatened the utilization of the Suez Canal. And I think it's fair to say that anybody who deals with oil has for a long time known about the immense volatility in both the supply and pricing of oil for a wide variety of reasons. And yet, these cases keep on coming up, and the court resolves them under this doctrine of impossibility. So we have to do a better job as lawyers in helping our clients recognize the danger they frequently don't want to think about those things. And they're afraid that if they raise them as possibilities, that the other side will back away. But you have to, and that's true, but you have to measure that risk against the fact that you can go ahead and be silent about this possibility, and the possibility occurs, and you're going to be left with this body of law, which is an uncertain body of law at best, particularly, of course, on the issue of what do we mean by commercial impracticability. The cases are pretty simple and pretty straightforward if it's physically impossible. But once I bridge into this area of commercial impracticability or frustration of purpose, all bets are off. All bets are off. I myself think that Chase Precast was wrongly decided, that those folks should have gotten their money, that the buyer buys, and when the buyer buys, they take the risk that what they're buying, they're not going to use. Suppose, after all, it had turned out that they had more of them than they wanted to buy. Could they refuse, saying, oh no, that was more than I thought, I don't need them? Of course not. They made an absolute agreement with respect to the number of these units they were going to buy. I feel they should have paid, they should have been paid their lost profits. That's just ridiculous for you to think so. We will move on from here. Follow the assignment sheet. See you on Monday. I know you guys, what, have all of you have moot court arguments this week or?
For the next 2 weeks.
Next 2 weeks. Let me say a few words about oral argument. Only if you want to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely.
The critical thing in oral argument is to force yourself to try to think in advance of every question that will be raised. Write them out. Imagine yourself being asked a question about what? About the things that you don't want to answer. About the weaknesses in your case, and figure out in advance how you're going to answer them. You're not going to answer them by saying, oh, Your Honor, that's a weakness in my case. So you're going to try to provide an answer which responds in some positive way. So write them out. A good lawyer in oral argument will have prepared about 85% of the questions that are going to be asked. Those 15%, they got to think fast on their feet. But you don't want to have to think fast on your feet for 100% of those questions. You'd be exhausted within the first few minutes. You can't do that. So write them out. Next. You may have written out your whole argument. That's a matter of style. If you do, fine. Do not bring it up to the rostrum with you. Do not. Because no matter how many times you say to yourself, I will maintain eye contact, I will not look down at my paper, I will not look down at my paper. If it's there, you'll look down at your paper. It's more important that you look at the eyes of the judge or judges that you are addressing. Very important. You'll never be persuasive staring down at a piece of paper. You can only be persuasive making eye contact with those judges. Don't bring it up. What should you bring up? You know, you're not going to argue your entire brief or memorandum. You don't have the time to do it. You want to identify about 3 points that you think these are the killer points. These are the ones that I've got to get. Write those 3 points down. Just a word or two, just to remember, just in case you feel, oh my God, what was the next point? Then you look down and then look up and talk. Bring up a minimum amount of material with you. And finally, know your record. Don't get any fact wrong. You need to know where it is in the record. If the record has various parts, know where it is in the record. So if you say, Your Honor, you don't need to say, if you're asked a question, well, where is that in the record? Your Honor, you will find that in the record in the testimony of so-and-so at so-and-so at such and such page. That's what you want to be able to do. If you have a case that you're going to cite as precedent, you need to be able to say quickly the basic facts of the case and the holding. No, I don't really remember that one too well, Your Honor. Good luck.
Thank you.